and impossible to imagine, a future. 15 years had passed, and the crime had never been solved. Its reckoning was long overdue. At first, I wore my story like an odd appendage, a Siamese twin. It was surely affixed to me, too freaky to ignore, yet not incorporated in any way into the rest of my life. Instead of pursuing its deeper implications, I would trot out the pain in my past for dramatic purposes. The cicatrix that snaked around my left forearm mellowed from scarlet to rose, but it was still strikingly visible when I rolled up my shirt sleeves. "It's a perfect axe cut," I'd say to those bold enough to ask, explaining that the coil around my left forearm was not a surgical incision, but the precise tracing left by an axe-wielding maniac whom I encountered one night. Then I might be inspired to uncloak the whole collection of hidden scars, ridges in my right shoulder where the truck first struck my body. "Tire treads etched into my skin," I would explain, "and the knob in the middle of my collarbone where it had broken and healed, subtracting 1.5 inches of chest span. Pulling up the bottom of my shirt, I would reveal a line of gentle bumps where the ribs had snapped in half." In the early years, I narrated my story with great levity, punctuating the recitation with laughter, a breezy chirp in my voice. In hindsight, I can see that the dispassionate way I told the story was, in the therapeutic idiom, a dissociative numbing, similar to how some war veterans spin their battle stories. But it was also a metaphor offered up from the deep folds of the psyche. I had split into 2 distinctly separate selves that summer night in June 1977. There was the official self, the bright and independent woman right out of Yale, coming of age with the rest of her baby boom peers. But there was also a scarecrow self, an unacknowledged, angry, aggrieved shadow who lived in a scarecrow body. It was plotting from the beginning to sabotage the other self. I had lived through the seemingly unsurvivable, and in the first years following the attack, I imagined myself impervious to destruction. Airtight, watertight, weather-stripped, puncture-proof, bulletproof, flame-proof. In a word, immortal. But reactions to trauma changed shape with the passage of years. The fears began imperceptibly, almost comically. I perceived danger lurking in things that were completely benign. Something as innocuous as polyester fabric sort of scared me. As though if you were wearing it and came too close to a match, you'd end up a fuse. Ordinary fly zappers with their eerie columns of neon blue light seemed especially sinister. One hung from a porch where I was chatting one day, and I couldn't hear what was being said because my ear was cocked to the buzzing zaps at slightly irregular intervals, signaling the sudden and random annihilation of a fly. Some part of me at the edges of consciousness had lost trust in the order of things. I no longer believed that life was following a script in which certain things would never happen. Evidence of this truth turned up in the newspaper one day. The story of a boy on vacation in Yellowstone Park who walked onto a dock to view the geyser pools. When a vapor kicked up, obscuring his vision, he stumbled into the water. By the time they fished him out, a matter of minutes, his bones were boiled clean. This last detail really made an impression on me, that something so out of the world horrific could happen on vacation in one of America's glorious national treasures like Yellowstone. By the end of my 20s, I was mysteriously debilitated. My concentration was dispersed. My breathing was shallow and erratic. My mother lived half a continent away from me, but that didn't stop me from calling her in a panic whenever I had the slightest ailment. A flicker of self-knowledge told me I needed repair, though I couldn't or wouldn't specifically attribute the damage to the violence I had endured at age 20. No one thing happened to make me touch bottom. I didn't sink into the oblivion of drugs or alcohol. Not once did I pop a Valium. I never had what others vaguely refer to as a nervous breakdown. but fear had fused with flesh. The exquisite responsiveness of my stress hormones made me susceptible to even small frights. I entered a new phase of living my life with tremendous caution. It seemed to me that it was a great risk to inhabit a body. Often I felt flashes of panic just to find myself encased in one. It was like those moments everyone has while careening down a 5-lane freeway. That instant when you wake up to the certainty that barreling at high speed in a skin of metal at the mercy of strangers around you can't be anything but perilous to tissue and bone. By my mid-30s, repetitive dreams were a staple of my nightlife. Walking on ice, I could get no forward traction. I screamed but found myself mute. I was stuck at the age of 20, unable to leave that stage of my life. There would be nothing but college forever. Nothing but living in dormitories or off-campus housing. Taking endless classes I would never complete. Studying lessons I couldn't learn. There could be no graduation. There would be no future. In these dreams, my own classmates had moved on, and I was still 20. I looked into the fresh faces of the new 20-year-olds, and there was no face I recognized. "What do you mean the files have been purged? I can't believe you'd throw out the files on a case like this. This was a major event in Oregon 15 years ago. I was nearly murdered." "But you weren't murdered." "So you're telling me if I were dead, you'd still have the files?" "That's what she was telling me." I had screwed up my courage to phone the Deschutes County, Oregon District Attorney's Office to locate any existing police records, and found myself on the line with the Victim's Assistance Office, talking to a haughty young woman who had little appreciation for my mission. "Look, this was a heinous, gruesome, unbelievably horrific crime. I really think the files must exist somewhere." She cut me off and asked in a tart, disparaging voice, "Was this a rape or something?" "No, it was not a rape. A man chopped me up with an axe." I got a call back the next day. The allegedly destroyed police reports had been located. The case was closed. Therefore, I was welcome to pick up the reports any weekday from the Records Department of the Oregon State Police in Salem. Police records awaited me in Oregon. A straight shot up Interstate 5, 1,000 miles north of my home. This prospect staggered me. I would return to that particular place for the very first time since I was taken out of there on a stretcher. When I first arrived in New Haven in the fall of 1975, I could not have imagined I might later want to escape this eastern bastion of privilege by hopping on a bicycle and pedaling through the long stretches of western desert. As a young girl in the Middle West, I had strived to get out of the sticks and into the urbane power centers of the East. I was hooked on the American aristocracy, and I set my sights on the Ivy League because of Caroline Kennedy. She was my age and my idol. At 14, I headed to the local library with the mission of researching every magazine article ever written about her. As I studied her freckled face, framed by a headband, I decided that surely Caroline would be the sort of girl to continue her patrilineage and attend Harvard. A singular resolve built inside me. However slim the odds, she would see me there. By the time I actually applied to colleges, thoughts of Caroline had fallen away, and New Haven had replaced Cambridge on my wish list. As soon as I reached the Ivy, I sanded off my Midwestern vowels and costumed myself in an arty, antique black woolen cape, which snapped in the brisk New Haven air. I was popular in a way I had never been among the anti-intellectual jocks of my suburban high school. I was finally among peers who appreciated my edgy, sardonic self. It was my first day at Yale when I met Shayna. "I'm Shayna," she said, unaffected and friendly, with a winsome smile, flashing perfect white teeth. S-H-A-Y-N-A. We stood in the hallway outside the suite of rooms where we had just unpacked the possessions we thought might help us in our transition from childhood. For me, that meant my typewriter, bicycle, some cameras, a mandolin, and a zither I didn't play. I noticed that. She